This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Bizarre and uncontrollable behaviors ruled Amy Walensky's life. As a child, teen, and young adult, her body contorted into painful positions. Her speech came in very short sentences, and she felt she absolutely had to touch wood. It wasn't until Walensky was a graduate student that she learned she suffered from obsessive-compulsive disorder, or OCD, and Tourette syndrome. Amy Walensky is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We'll talk with her about Tourette syndrome and OCD and how she's come to terms with the disorders. Your questions are welcome. Listeners, you can join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Amy Walensky is a writer whose articles and reviews have appeared in national magazines, including Self. She is a graduate of Vassar College and Columbia University's Master of Fine Arts writing program. Amy Walensky is the author of Passing for Normal, a memoir of compulsion. The book, nominated for the 1999 National Book Awards, is published by Broadway Books. Amy Walensky, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I should tell you that I have some guaranteed listeners out there. My husband's family is all from Champaign-Urbana, so I'd like to just say hello to the Hones and the O'Connors, as well as Liesl and Tedra.
Okay. Well, our greetings to them as well, and glad they're with us this afternoon.
Yes.
Let's start with some background information. What should we know about these conditions or disorders, OCD and Tourette syndrome?
Well, I mean, that's part of the reason I wrote this book is that people really either don't know very much about either of these conditions or know the wrong things. And there's a lot of misinformation about both of these conditions. And they're, you know, they obviously have a wide range of symptoms and vary case to case, but there's some sort of basic definitions that are good to know. And Tourette syndrome, the most simple way to describe it is that it's a tic disorder. It's a neurobiological condition. It's not psychological, as people have thought for years. It's a neurobiological condition that causes people to have tics, most commonly physical tics, although, again, people tend to associate it with vocal tics, which that condition, which is called coprolalia, only affects 10% of people with Tourette syndrome. So it's primarily physical tics, such as eye blinking, jerking your head to the side, hand and wrist tics, all sorts of things. There's really sort of an infinite number. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is also a neurobiological condition that causes people to adhere to really inexplicable patterns or rituals. People will have obsessive thoughts, maybe that they're in danger or they're going to come down with some certain sickness or that someone they love is going to be harmed, and then will perform compulsions to negate the obsessional thinking.
And this was interesting to learn, that people with Tourette's, at least 50%, also have obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Yes, that's true. That's another thing that people don't know. Obsessive-compulsive disorder, it's probably even a higher number than that. The conditions are very interrelated. I mean, sometimes in people who have both, it's very hard to discern what's a tic and what's a compulsive behavior. So they're very interrelated. But it's also interesting to note that obsessive-compulsive disorder, although it does occur in so many people with Tourette syndrome, is incredibly common. I mean, much more common than Tourette syndrome. And a statistic that I found personally sort of shocking was that more people have obsessive-compulsive disorder than have either asthma or diabetes, which sort of hits home how common it is.
Wow. Are we aware of this, or are people, you know, like to take the title of your book, Passing for Normal?
Well, yeah, I think that's a good point. I mean, I think that we're not really aware of it, because most people, these aren't conditions that are necessarily even visible to an outside observer. Most, they're really fairly internalized. So you know, the chances are that someone you work with or, you know, I have been told that there's probably a kid in every classroom who has one of these conditions to some degree. You know, that's in the United States. Someone sitting next to you on a train or a subway or so, you know, they're really, most people know someone fairly well who has one of these conditions, who, and they're probably not aware of it themselves. I mean, these are still going incredibly widely undiagnosed.
Hmm. So do we have any idea of how many people suffer from sort of the more serious range of these disorders?
Well, they're both considered spectrum disorders, which mm-hmm. is interesting because that means that under the category of either heading, you will have people who will be literally incapacitated and not able to leave their homes or not able to hold a job, and then you will have people who are among the most successful, you know, people in our society who have, you know, a touch of one of these conditions that may even work in a positive way. I mean, there's a obsessive-compulsive disorder in particular, I think, is responsible for a lot of people, you know, a lot of people's drive and ambition, in a sense. So in terms of the very severely afflicted, it's a relatively small percentage. I mean, most people, almost everyone I've met with either Tourette syndrome or obsessive-compulsive disorder has really learned to live with it and use it in many cases even to their own advantage.
Hmm. You write in the book that these conditions for you and for others that you know are suppressible but ultimately unstoppable.
Yes.
So how do you go about suppressing them, and do you always want to suppress them?
Well,
if they can be something that can spur you to, you know, be more creative or ambitious?
That's an interesting question. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a line that is stepped over in terms of diagnostic criteria, and that's really, you know, to what extent these conditions are interfering with your life. And that really means, you know, when they cross over the line from being something positive to being something negative, and especially in terms of the tics. I mean, I think I meant most specifically the physical tics when I was talking about the ability to suppress them. And I think that people do suppress them. I mean, it's probably the same thing if you feel like you're going to sneeze in an important meeting or maybe at a funeral or someplace where you're really supposed to be quiet and you exert all of your energy. I think most people have probably experienced this, to really, you know, try to hold it back. And it's similar to that. At some point, if your body is telling you that you need to sneeze, that sneeze is going to have to come out. A tic is fairly similar to that. I mean, you can really just sort of focus all of your concentration on not doing it if you're in a situation where you feel like it might be, you know, not advantageous to do so, but then eventually it's going to come out.
Hmm. What kinds of medications and therapies are out there to help folks live with these conditions?
Yeah, there are some very, very good medications available, especially for obsessive-compulsive disorder. The obsessive-compulsive disorder is highly treatable, and it's most treatable with a combination of medication. The most common medication is Prozac, which people think of as being an antidepressant and is obviously a very common and successful antidepressant, but is also the number one medication prescribed for obsessive-compulsive disorder. It really seems to cut down on the compulsive behaviors. And then what is called behavioral or cognitive therapy, which is basically a way of desensitizing yourself to performing the rituals by chipping away at them one by one until your brain has learned not to make you perform these behaviors. It's really, that to me is a fascinating aspect, the behavioral therapy, because there's a team of researchers at UCLA who have proved that behavioral therapy actually changes the chemistry of the brain. They do MRIs of people before and after having gone through behavioral therapy, and it actually changes the brain, which is pretty fascinating to me. The medications for Tourette syndrome are not as successful, largely because they have fairly debilitating side effects.
Well, what's your experience with the medications and behavior modification therapy?
Well, my experience has been fairly typical, I would say. I've had tremendous success with medication and behavioral therapy in terms of the obsessive-compulsive disorder. I mean, that has really been pretty much eliminated. I don't, obviously, if I'm under a lot of stress or in a very tense situation, sometimes I will revert to behaviors or patterns. But generally, that doesn't really interfere with my life very much at all. So I've had a very successful experience with that combination. In terms of the Tourette syndrome, I've tried some of the medications, which are, the category is called tic suppressants, and the way they work is that they affect the part of your brain that causes these physical movements. And I have found that the side effects, primarily just the intense fatigue that they cause, is really not worth it to me. And at this point, I'm 29 years old. I've had tics for most of my life. I've pretty much, decided that unless something really terrific comes along that isn't going to make me feel like a zombie, that I'm just going to deal with it. And that's a fairly common experience. There's a very famous essay written by Oliver Sacks about a well-known jazz musician who has tics that are much more severe than mine. And his solution, which I thought was kind of interesting, was that he does take his medication during the week when he's practicing and performing, and then goes off the medication on weekends. It's sort of when he allows himself to really be himself and go crazy with his tics, and that works for him. So I think people, arrive at something that works for them. But I do hope that the medications for Tourette syndrome improve, and I think there is research being done and work being done in that direction. So yeah. Keep my fingers crossed.
Yeah, let's talk with a caller. We've got a caller waiting for us on line one. A caller in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Want to say thanks for having something about mental health on, and I'm really thrilled to hear the word neurobiological because I think people frequently misunderstand that. Let's see. I mainly wanted to ask your guest, first of all, what kind of things she feels are helpful in attitudes with people who are maybe near someone or close to someone or involved with someone who's living with obsessions and compulsions. And then if you could you tell us if you do have obsessions, if you have the agony of thought? So I will just hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay.
Well, I think that the most important thing in terms of dealing with someone who's obsessive-compulsive is, in my personal experience, the understanding that these weren't things that I was doing on purpose. I think if you don't understand or know about obsessive-compulsive disorder, it's very easy to think that the things someone is doing are, deliberate and that the person is trying to drive you nuts, and they're not. I mean, people with obsessive-compulsive disorder have full awareness that the things that they're doing are irrational or annoying or, otherwise unpleasant to the people around them. No one likes to deal with someone who's completely, who's so wrapped up in the organization of the things around them, and someone who has to have everything their own way and in their own place and, moves things around in irrational patterns. And, I know from experience that I've my parents and my husband have, before I was diagnosed and knew what we were dealing with, would say, why do you have to do that? And I think having the answer has made a big difference, saying to have people know that the reason I have to do it is because of a glitch in the brain, I think has been, tremendously valuable to us. So I think that awareness and really learning what you can, everything that you can about the condition, is the very best way to help someone who's going through this. I also think that, trying as hard as you can not to, it doesn't help to nag, it doesn't help to to point out behaviors that the person is fully aware of. It really helps just to be understanding and to listen. And when the person, you know, asks you for help, maybe they want you to go with them to talk to someone about this, then I think that's, if you can do that, then you're doing the best that you can. And in terms of the agony of obsessions, I have experienced obsessional thinking. I mean, I've been, which in my experience has taken the form of, you know, fairly severe hypochondria at certain points, and obsessions with death and dying. They're both very common. And, you know, as anyone who's ever experienced obsessional thinking, and to be honest, I really think that most people have experienced obsessive-compulsive behaviors or thoughts in some capacity at some point in their life. It's incredibly distracting, and it's not something pleasant, and I think that, you know, again, the best thing you can do is seek treatment and talk to someone and figure out what the best ways to help yourself can be.
Mm. Let's talk with another caller on line four, our toll-free line, a caller in Bloomington. Hi.
Good afternoon. Amy, I was hoping you could describe the progression of the Tourette's from childhood through your early adult years at this point. And if I could hang up and listen, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. Well, I first noticed physical tics when I was about 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, quickly my parents also noticed. And after a couple months of this, when it appeared, you know, I tried to pretend that they were somehow, you know, maybe a sports injury, or when it became clear that that wasn't the case, we went to my pediatrician. And as most kids who are experiencing tics and don't want anyone to notice them, I did a fairly good job of suppressing them in any doctor's office. And, you know, my mother would say, but really, she does do this at home. And the doctor would say, well, she looks okay to me. And that went on for pretty much the duration of my experience with a pediatrician. And, you know, then I left for college and had experienced over childhood and adolescence a whole array of different tics at different times, which is characteristic of Tourette syndrome. The tics tend to wax and wane. Sometimes they're very bad, and sometimes they completely disappear. So, you know, in that way, my experience was fairly typical. My tics are fairly, you know, they're in the mild to moderate range, and in many cases go completely unnoticed unless someone is actually looking for them. And when I got through college and I moved to New York, and for the first time I was living away from my family as an adult, and took myself to a doctor because it had become clear to me that all of the things that we had heard over the years, that I had a nervous tic, that I had a temporary childhood tic, you know, after I guess about 17 or 18 years, it was clear to me that this wasn't a transient tic. This was something that had arrived and stuck around. So it wasn't until I took myself to a doctor and said, I'm going to tell you exactly what my experience has been, and I'm going to, you know, give you the whole story, and I want you to tell me what you think, that I was first diagnosed. And it sounds, people tend to be surprised that I wasn't diagnosed until I was in my 20s. I've met people who were diagnosed with Tourette syndrome at the age of 65 or later, and people can live an entire lifetime without being diagnosed with this. Mm-hmm. But that was pretty much my experience.
Yeah. You know, this idea of passing and coping and covering.
Yes.
You worked on this from the very outset, from the first tics you experienced when you were a little girl of 8 or 9. These were tics that were noticed by your friends and your mom right away.
Yes.
And you told your mom you'd pulled a neck muscle in ballet class.
Yes.
And you then immediately asked her for an aspirin. Well, a great cover story, but it's not an explanation that can stand up for very long.
No, you wouldn't think.
Yeah. But what other kinds of things did you do to to cope, to cover?
Well, I think that especially in childhood and even more so in adolescence, I think that most kids and teenagers are very concerned with not standing out from other kids. So I think someone who has tics, which can be, you know, bizarre or odd and certainly appear inexplicable, is going to be even more concerned with keeping people from noticing. And, you know, as a teenager, I had all sorts of sort of covering strategies. I know when I talk to people I went to high school and college with now, they all remember I used to have my hair sort of over my face, and people would always, you know, be brushing my hair out of my eyes and saying, you know, teachers would always say, come on, tuck your hair behind your ears with, let's see that face. And I think my tic at that time, my most frequent tic was a sort of eye-rolling tic. And I think that, you know, I had my hair arranged like that as a concealing mechanism. And I didn't realize that at the time, which is sort of funny to me now. But now it seems incredibly obvious. I often wore baseball caps with brims, which lots of teenagers wear baseball caps. I mean, I don't know, there are probably on any given day 30 kids at my school wearing a baseball cap. But that's another way. If you have a brim over your forehead, people aren't going to notice your eyes doing funny things or blinking or whatever the particular tic may be. So there are all sorts of things like that, you know, physical means of concealing tics that I've found from talking to other people who are now sort of in adulthood and through those teenage years, which are difficult enough for anyone, that people have devised very similar means of concealing.
Yeah. Well, your family was concerned and frustrated, and your father didn't know what to do, and he said some pretty hurtful things. How did you and the family make it through those years?
Well, and I think I'm very fortunate in that I have a really amazing family, and we've always been very close. And my mother has been an educator for over 30 years and is very sensitive to children and things that they might be going through. So even though we didn't know specifically what I was experiencing, she knew that there was something, and that the most important way to deal with it was with sensitivity and with tolerance. My father had a much more difficult time with my tics, and it was fairly unpleasant about it for years. And I have to say that I feels incredibly, incredibly guilty about it now. And he should. I mean, he didn't handle it well. But in his defense, I think I have to say that as a parent, you know, I am the first child in my family, and you know, my father was a first time parent, and I think that he had a lot of fears for me. I think that the things that he said were clearly motivated by his concern that I was going to be picked on, or that other kids were going to notice this and latch onto it. And, you know, I think it's very difficult as a parent to, I'm not a parent myself, but I can imagine that it must be incredibly hard to see your kid struggling with something that's obviously making them miserable and think that they can control it and sort of wish that they could control it, even if you maybe subconsciously know that they can't. And I think that was our experience. And it did make for some very difficult conversations and some fighting and battling. I think one of the most interesting things that has come out of my writing this book is that my father has been diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, which sheds new light on some of our struggles with this together. I think that maybe he had a very hard time with this, partly because he may have recognized some things in himself that he hadn't really been prepared to deal with.
We're talking this afternoon with Amy Walensky. She has Tourette's syndrome and obsessive-compulsive disorder, and she's written about her experiences. The book's titled Passing for Normal, A Memoir of Compulsion. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. We have some folks waiting to talk with us. We'll go next to Urbana, a caller on line one. Hello.
This is George R. Carlisle from Urbana. Yes, I think I have obsessive-compulsive disorders or have had episodes of those from the times. Over the past several years, there were times when I had was obsessed with taking pictures of colored slides, and I used some colored filters. I picked them up at a bargain counter in a local camera store in 1985, and I shot a lot of pictures. It's not that it's harmful itself, but it was rather financially devastating. The habit of doing that, I've got a whole chest of drawers full of slides that taken from that. I never have been able to quite figure out why I had that problem. I'm doing my best to overcome it because of financial constraints right now. And then I had an obsession with a Krannert Center performance. That had to do with one of the former staff members who has since left to study towards being a minister. And there were times that going to Krannert and so forth was seeming to rule my life, too, also because of the higher price of tickets. I'm having to put some of the brakes on that, but I seem like I've had problems like that. I know some other people who've had problems. I know a person, a former geologist, a geological survey, who seemed to have an obsession with books because he kept buying books and books from a catalog and didn't even have really a place to store them except many warehouses and didn't get around to reading them all, but he was still buying a lot of books. And my step-grandmother, she passed away in 1977. She used to buy dresses or material for sewing. She didn't get around to sewing a lot of them. It was the act of buying the material and dresses. Some of the shoes she bought she never wore because she never made the dresses that she intended to go with them. We had quite a job when she passed away and had an estate sale trying to move some things that were 20 and 30 years old. But people do seem to have some of these problems, and it's hard to understand why. There must be an explanation for it.
You want to comment, Amy?
The things that you're talking about are fairly common. Obsessive-compulsive disorder affects the same part of the brain that affects addictive behaviors, and people can end up getting themselves into tremendous financial problems, as you said you had experienced, by becoming really to a point. I mean, there's a difference. People will say, but you like taking pictures, it's a hobby. There are people who like taking pictures and it's a hobby, and they take pictures of things that they enjoy taking pictures of, and of special events or occasions. And there are people who are professional photographers and take a lot of pictures. And then there's something else entirely, which is where you sort of lose the element of the pleasure in taking pictures and are more focused on the compulsive need to take a certain number of pictures, or where you almost lose track of what you're taking the pictures of. I mean, I think that's what you're talking about. And that's actually a pretty good way to highlight the difference between someone who has a passion for something or a hobby and someone who has stepped over that line. It's when you really are, lots of people like to go shopping and will buy themselves clothes. If you're buying clothes that you're never going to wear, and you're buying them because some part of your brain is pushing you toward the act of buying, and it's not really about the clothes anymore, that's when we're talking about obsessive compulsive disorder. So I think the things that you've described. I mean, another very common feature of obsessive compulsive disorder is people whose apartments become, or houses, or wherever they're living, become literally taken over by something that they've been obsessed with. I mean, one case that I've read about was a man who became obsessed with buying newspapers and had newspapers stacked up to the ceiling to the point where he couldn't even walk around his own home because it was stuffed to the gills with newspapers. That's not someone who's really into the newspaper and likes to get the daily news, that's someone who has a problem. So I think what you're talking about is, you know, drawing the line between enjoying something and having the enjoyment sucked out by a condition that is treatable and could, you know, basically what I'm trying to say is that you can have the pleasure restored to something when it's been taken away by obsessive compulsive disorder, and I think that's when you, at that point, is when you need to really seek treatment and face the problem head on.
Yeah. Let's thank our caller for his call this afternoon and go on to our next caller who's waiting for us on line four, a caller in Aurora. Hello? Is there a caller there?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah. I have a friend that I've known over 30 years that is obsessive compulsive. And I used to deal with it and handle it and... because she has, her family members have died, friends that she used to have moved away, and of course she hasn't made new friends. And I guess I'm having difficulty with the friendship. Not that I see her very often. I don't, because I can't handle it. Because I want to be honest. If I see something or if I want to answer her some way, I want to be honest about my answer.
I'm sorry, I can't. At this point, I'm unable to hear the caller.
What?
I'm sorry. For a minute there, the phone cut out, and I don't know if it's just
it's
a problem.
Can you hear now?
I can hear you now.
Okay. Well, anyway, I guess I'm having problems. I went through her obsessiveness with men and her obsessiveness with vitamin B shots. She wanted them once a week, and I knew that she shouldn't have them, but once a month. You know, I went through all the past behaviors, and I decided years ago that I can't do it anymore. She's very kind. She's very gentle. She tries, and I know she's trying very hard. But I always feel... I want to be honest with her, and because I'm about her last friend she has, if I say anything, I come on kind of strong because I'm the only one that's saying what I'm saying. Do you understand? So what I'm saying is, can I say to her, I want to be honest with you, this is how I feel?
What I would do, I mean, I think that the most important thing to remember, and since I don't know this woman and I don't know, you know, all of the ways in which this affects her life and your friendship, it's hard for me to be too specific, but I think that, you know, it sounds like some of the behaviors that she exhibits are things that she can't help, and I think it's important to remember that...
I did.
Well, I think that, I mean, maybe... One thing that you could do is like many people, she may have never heard of obsessive compulsive disorder. She may not know that she's probably fairly miserable dealing with some of these things. I mean, people with obsessive compulsive disorder are not very happy and end up spending a lot of time, you know, wasted time doing things that they don't really want to do.
Oh, yeah, she drives me up a wall with some of the things
she does. Well,
that's
very common. I think... anyone with obsessive compulsive disorder has had that said about them at some point or another, but she may well not know that there's a condition, and a very common condition that is certainly nothing to be ashamed of, and a very treatable condition, and maybe...
So can I ask her that? That would be you.
I would say you could say, you know, say you heard it on the radio, say I heard this radio show, and it was... You know, I found it very interesting, and some of the stuff reminded me of you, and I was wondering if you'd ever heard about this or if you would be interested in finding out about it because, you know, maybe we could make life a little easier for you. I would couch it that way.
I did try that with, she says she has myasthenia gravis, and I tried to prompt her to get a test last year.
Okay.
Well, she found out that the test isn't 100% correct. and that it's very expensive and she wasn't going to have it. And that's kind of how she handles things. She kind of puts them aside. She makes the decision. You know, instead of the doctor making the decision, she makes the decision. So I think to myself, she probably will do the same thing with this if I say anything to her.
Hmm.
And
well,
I guess that's
a risk that you're going to take by telling her about it. But I think if you maybe if you pose it in a way, in a very conversational way, in a sort of isn't this interesting way, and you know all of these, you know, 1 out of 40 people Americans have some form of this condition, and what do you think about it? Maybe get her talking about it a little bit. If as long as she doesn't feel like she's being attacked or that you're diagnosing her with something, you know, which might make her feel uncomfortable, if you could get her talking about it and reading about it a little bit. I don't know if she's online or there's a lot of stuff on the internet about this. There are other books that have been written, clinical books, you know, by doctors.
Pick up Amy's book, read it, and pass it along to your friend. Say, I really enjoyed reading this.
I would hope that's why I wrote this book.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would hope that it may be of some help.
Yeah. The caller, though, also, I mean, the pain of this woman must be in, in terms of her loneliness, in terms of having this, you know, isolating her from life. It's tough.
It's tough. It's also it's quite common with people who are, you know, the more severely afflicted people are, the more difficult the time they have interacting with other people and basically being out in the world because there are so many obstacles, things that prevent them from going about their daily life. And it does sound like this woman is fairly isolated. And I think having a support system and having people who around you who know what you're going through, I think that's very important. So I think that if the caller can, I know the behaviors can be incredibly annoying and incredibly difficult to deal with, but if you're this woman's only friend, you know, I think that, you know, arming her with knowledge could be the beginning of the path back to normal life for her.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller for her call this afternoon, and we've got some other callers waiting, so let's go to our next caller on line 2 in Champaign. Hi.
Yes, hello. Do you hear me all right?
Yes.
Yes, I just returned from a trip to New Bern, North Carolina, where I attended my granddaughter Kimberly's first birthday. And as a result of that, she showed me a picture of a young lady on the beach at Door County having her foot massaged. And I tell you, that was got to me chuckly, and I chuckled and chuckled, and then I realized it was this fine author of a new book.
I wanted to call in and
congratulate her on the fine work she's doing, and we all love her.
Oh, thank you. This is my husband's grandfather.
Yeah, that's right.
It took me a second there.
Enjoyed the program very well, Amy, and hope to see you soon.
Oh, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call this afternoon. What a nice thing to do.
Very nice.
Very nice thing to do. Our guest this afternoon, Amy Wilensky, and her husband's grandfather is Right on the Money, Passing for Normal, A Memoir of Compulsion, is a very fine work. Let's talk with another caller on line 1 in Bloomington. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I think most of us have a picture of obsessive compulsive stereotype as people who are obsessed with something. And a good example is in one of Dickens' novels, the fellow, whatever conversation you're having with him, sooner or later he brings up the subject of King Charles's head. He was the king who was executed by the British, beheaded, back in 1650 or something. But could you give us me some examples of some more subtle behaviors that we might sometimes think a friend is neurotic? I was amazed when you mentioned hypochondria, that was an obsessive compulsive disorder. I've heard perfectionism described in the same way. So I was wondering if you could mention some more subtle behaviors that we might even have names for, but which might be indications of OCD.
Okay. Let me clarify a little bit what I said before.
Put on the radio. You can listen to it.
I would say hypochondria is not obsessive-compulsive disorder. However, if someone is obsessing about about illness or a specific illness or just being ill in general or about dying or about getting cancer, I mean, these are very common, about being in a car accident. You know, that's not exactly hypochondria, but along the same lines. And then performs compulsive behaviors in order to prevent themselves from becoming ill or from getting whatever condition it is they're obsessed with, that's when it becomes obsessive compulsive behavior. So I know at the beginning of the show it was mentioned, I write in the book about a trip that I took with my family when I was very obsessed with planes and flying and the fact that a plane I was on was going to crash. I developed a compulsive behavior of touching wood and mm-hmm. somehow knowing rationally as a rational person that if I were to touch wood, that would have absolutely nothing to do, not connected in any way with the safety of a plane flight. Somehow when you're in the throes of obsessive compulsive disorder, your brain sort of plays a little trick on you and causes you to do something of compulsive behavior. In my case, it was the touching wood, and tricks you into thinking that that behavior is going to somehow prevent the disaster, in my case, the crashing of a plane. So it's really the connection between the obsessional thought and the compulsive behavior that defines OCD. I don't know if I made that clear before. But there are all kinds of things. I mean, maybe someone who is an obsessive compulsive who is afraid of that they're going to be hit by a car. And I know someone who had this experience. When you see them walking around on the street, you wouldn't notice this unless you were looking for it, but they may be meticulously counting their steps. Maybe they will be finishing every stretch of walk they're taking with an even number of steps. Or maybe they will be, you know, it's kind of the example of the old childhood mm-hmm. stepping on a crack sort of times 100. It's that's something that seems, could seem innocuous, but could really end up, I mean, imagine if you're walking around or out in the world for 12 or 14 hours a day and you're counting every single step that you take. I mean, that's something that's certainly interfering with someone's life. So another example could be, a very common example is maybe you become obsessed with, and I feel like I'm using general examples, but they often are general examples. I mean, if you're obsessed with dying, for example, you could convince yourself that if your bookshelves are alphabetized, that was somehow going to be a charm against anything bad happening to you. And there's really, I mean, there are as many examples of obsessive-compulsive behaviors as there are people. I mean, there are more. There are millions. They're infinite. And the brain is pretty remarkable in that it can devise, it can come up with the craziest stuff, you know, that doesn't seem to make any sense at all. But it's that's why obsessive-compulsive disorder needs to be diagnosed and needs to be treated, because people can really regain control of their time and of their lives with the proper help and treatment.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here. Let me ask you this last question, and your answer, I'm afraid, could you make it brief, please?
I will try.
What's your take these days on the word normal?
Oh, geez, that's going to be hard to make that short.
I'm sorry.
I think, well, I think that the first psychiatrist I ever saw said to me, I said, you know, I'm just afraid that I'm not normal, that there's something wrong with me. And he said, you know what, I've been in this business for a long time, and there's no such thing as normal. And that has stuck with me, and I think will stick with me for as long as I live, because I think that, you know, if you scratch the surface of most people's mm-hmm. lives deep enough, you will find a whole number of ways in which they are different from whatever their standards of normal may be, no matter what they like to think of themselves. And in my mind, out of the people I know, you know, I wouldn't want to be described as normal. To me, I associate it with a certain banality, a certain, you know, I tend to like people who I find to be quirky or unusual or maybe even odd in some way. So, you know, I just remember that there's no such thing as normal, and I think that people should celebrate the things about them that are different.
Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Amy Walensky has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for her book, Passing for Normal, A Memoir of Compulsion, the publisher, Broadway Books.